You are listening to the podcast When Life Gives You Lemons, presented by me, Emma Levy. Having worked with elite athletes for most of my career, it's always intrigued me that a significant number of high-performing individuals have encountered some form of adversity earlier in their lifetime. My fascination into this grew when I had my own brush with adversity, when I was diagnosed with breast cancer in May 2020, in the midst of the global pandemic at the age of only 36. During this period, I questioned whether it was my positive mindset or maybe something else, which enabled me to bounce back and to train and compete for a triathlon just 1 month following completion of all active cancer treatment. The goal of this podcast is to explore this concept further by meeting a variety of high-performing individuals who have been through adversity, but who have come back stronger. Today, I'm welcoming Vicky Silverthorne to the podcast. After I've introduced Vicky, you will 100% want a Vicky in your life. Vicky is a professional organiser, helping people to declutter and organise their homes. She is an entrepreneur, setting up her own business, You Need a Vicky, in 2010. Alongside running a successful business, writing an Amazon best-selling book, Start With Your Sock Drawer, Vicky is also a solo adoptive mum, adopting her daughter during the COVID pandemic. Vicky is passionate about sharing her story of adoption as a single mum, so I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Vicky, thank you for coming to London today.
Thank you very much for having me.
I have to ask, how does one become a professional organiser?
Well, so taking us back to 2010, what, 14 years ago-ish, I was working for a pop star, Lily Allen. I was her PA. And she had had someone come in and help organise her wardrobe and style her as well, kind of thing, you know, new clothes and shoes. I loved the organisation part of that. I mean, I was suddenly fascinated by this idea that that was a job. But I know I'm not good at styling someone. So I kind of reined it in my head and thought, well, I'd love to do that. And I'd love to do the organisation of the wardrobe for people, but also a kitchen and the rest of the house. And I could see how much it would change people's lives. And even watching Lily, you know, the sort of freeing up of the mind when all these clothes were going out the door. So that's what started it. And then with Lily's lovely support, I left and sort of passed that job on.
How long had you been her PA for?
Around 3 years.
And you were touring internationally?
Touring internationally around the world. It was her album, It's Not You, It's Me. You know, the fear, and it was the most unbelievable job ever. It was fantastic. And
Hard
Lily
work?
Was settling down and having kids. Yeah. So, you know, I felt like I'd really ticked my boxes in a job, like more than. I felt so lucky.
You didn't want to keep doing it though?
No, I felt, I mean, you know, pop stars do these tours constantly. I don't know how. I was exhausted after, I mean, I was literally diagnosed with exhaustion after the tour. And I loved it. But yeah, the role was changing and I knew deep down, I knew I had the entrepreneur in me. And I knew deep down this was time to kind of try and go out on my own and make something happen. I knew what I wanted long term. Mm. And to start with, it sort of didn't work and then it worked. To start with, I went out as a sort of PA and I started a website of my name and I thought I'd be a PA. And then I thought, I don't want to be a PA. I haven't got that in me anymore. Mm. But it was the organising I focused on. And back then, there was no one doing it.
Yeah.
There really was hardly anyone in the UK doing it. But in the States, it was huge. And it was, you know, my radar was like, ding, 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 ding.
Yeah. And I read in your book, Start With Your Sock Drawer,
yeah.
Which I did read, actually.
Oh,
and
good.
I must tell you, it has actually changed me over the past few weeks. And it's the funniest thing. You say to start with your sock drawer.
Yeah.
But I didn't. I started with my running legging drawer.
Love that. Yeah.
And I did exactly what you said. And I've rolled all the leggings up so I can see them all when I open the drawer, rather than all being a pile. And it has made a difference to my life.
Yeah.
But you wrote, I've written down here because it kind of resonated to me, simple living has a direct relationship to well-being and mindfulness.
Yeah.
And I think we do so much to help other parts of our lives, but I do think the majority of people do ignore decluttering their homes.
Yeah.
Why do you think we do that? Why do you think we ignore it?
Well, firstly, I think you're so right. You know, positive well-being, very much you think of breathing and yoga and walking in nature. But the one scenario I always talk to people about or sort of try and put across is, you know, you've done those things, you've gone for your walk in nature and you feel and your shoulders have gone from up high and they've gone down. And then you walk through your door and staring at you in the face is, you know, hundreds of things and stuff everywhere. Your shoulders are going to go straight back up. It's a, you know, the studies have been done that this visual stuff, this has such an impact on the mind and the brain and our ability to think clearly, our energy levels, our productivity. I mean, the list goes on and on and on.
So there's scientific research backing this up, is there?
Yeah, there's a lot of studies. I mean, there's a lady called Sabine Kastner, who I've always been a little bit obsessed with, and I always wait for any new information coming out. But she did a lot of studies about the impact of sort of visual on us.
And I heard you say that a tidy room has been proven to be beneficial for sleep.
Absolutely. Yeah. Imagine sleeping on a bed with all this stuff under. I mean, it's my idea of hell, sleeping on a bed where there's just this stuff been sort of shoved underneath and you don't know what's there, festering, and that can't be good for the mind. To me, that is sort of as bad as if you are going to sleep with your work emails open, staring you in the face. Like, it can't be good. Or a whiteboard in your bedroom with your list of to-dos. Like, no yeah. to any of it. Yeah.
It's very interesting because I'm a very organized person.
Yeah.
So at home, my desk is, you know, I have to keep it totally free of clutter.
Yeah.
But then my middle son is totally messy.
Yeah.
I describe him like an 8-year-old hoarder.
Yeah. You know,
everything he's made at school is lying out on his desk, on his floor, on his chest of drawers. He won't let me get rid of anything.
Yeah.
And he's just been away for a 2-day residential.
Yeah.
And I've warned him, but I have totally decluttered his room.
Oh my gosh.
I did warn him and we spoke about it a lot. But again, it was follow your book and knowing I was coming to meet you here today.
Yeah.
And I have totally decluttered his room. And I'm so looking forward to seeing how that affects his sleep, his mood.
Amazing. And my prediction is that he will come back in and discover things that he hasn't seen for so long.
Well, I got rid of everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's got nothing to
but
discover.
It's interesting because even if there's a full shelf of stuff, so much of it, especially to younger adults, teenagers, children, it's not visible. It becomes completely invisible. You the mind can't pick it out. It's too busy. And for kids, you know, I could go on and on, but you know, with my daughter, I ensure there's not too much for her to look at. I think it's massive. And actually, can I just add something in about that I found interesting? So we have these amazing sort of therapy sessions with my daughters, and even the occupational therapist said the school classroom is too busy.
Mm.
So if they're talking about school classrooms, the sort of the visuals, they should be a lot clearer, not so much busy to look at, to help children focus more. I mean, that's a classroom. Of course we should be doing it in our homes too. You know, it's kinder to them. It's kinder to their mind. So it's a massive thing that I feel like I just want to delve into a lot more.
Oh, massively. Next on my list is the playroom. That is going to be a disaster.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm going to just go in and be strong and harsh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it'll feel
good.
Amazing. Yeah.
And simple storage as well. That's a really big tip of mine. Really simplistic storage. Nothing too complicated. So they can put things away and be in control of their stuff. I think that's important.
Good point. Back in the day, I think people listening might have heard of Marie Kondo.
Yes.
Because I know I'd heard of Marie Kondo.
Yeah.
And am I right in saying her philosophy is to get rid of everything that doesn't give you joy?
Yeah, doesn't spark joy, I think.
Doesn't spark joy. So I wanted to ask you what your thoughts on that approach are.
Okay. So although I think she's the absolute, I mean, best, what she's achieved in her life, you know, is amazing. I wish I'd have done things in a slightly more cool way like she did. But what I would say is, as a day-to-day, it wouldn't be possible for me to use certain techniques that she does for my clients. Number one, it would take perhaps too long longer than the client would want to spend on it. Keeping people's attention, when someone's time poor, they already only have a certain amount of time to give us. So we're working really speedily. And also, I suppose, you know, there are a lot of things that I keep that give me zero joy at all. But as a solo mum who's someone who has to get ahead in the dishwasher to fix it if it breaks, sadly, my spanner and, you know, whatever the other tools are called that I don't know the name of have to stay. You know, they're useful. So I think I probably own quite a few things that I don't want to own and that give me no joy at all. But I think her ways are fantastic. And I think we have to remember that everything professional organisers say is should be thought of as a guideline mm-hmm. as opposed to a rule. So I think people could pick so much of out of what she says. And even if they don't follow it 100%, they'll still get so much out of it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So you've got to think of the practical as well in your own life. And there's no rule because there is no home, life, family scenario. There's nothing the same. Every home you go into, it's like a snowflake.
Yeah.
Every client we have is completely individual.
Yeah.
Similar sometimes, but never the same. Never the same.
Yeah. And that must make your job quite difficult. And then on top of having this difficult job, you obviously didn't want a simple life because you have fairly recently adopted a daughter as a single mum.
That's right. Yeah.
And I do want to go on to talk about that journey.
Great.
Are you happy to talk about that?
More than, yeah, absolutely.
Brilliant. So firstly, what made you want to embark on the adoption route?
So I was in my late 30s and I quite simply hadn't met someone that I wanted to spend my life with and have a child with. And, you know, when you're younger, it's very much on the cards. And I didn't think for a minute that won't happen. That's not a possibility. But you know what? Quite simply, it didn't. And I knew I wanted children. I knew that I would regret not having children in the future, I think is a better description. So I then looked into options. You know, I could get donor, I could adopt, and I did look into both. But when I went to an adoption evening where there were 20 chairs and only four were filled, and these two fantastic women at the front talking about adoption and the process and the reality behind it, I honestly, I hadn't told a soul I was going, and I left that meeting room and I got into my car and I knew, and I always say, I wonder if this is what people feel when they get the positive pregnancy test, but I knew from that second I was adopting and that I would be a mum.
Really?
And I was buzzing about it. I was like sitting in my car holding my steering wheel, buzzing about it.
So what do you think it was that they said in that meeting that made you feel like that?
God, that's such a good question. I've never been asked. I think it was honestly almost in me. I spoke to my dad and I said, when I told him that I was definitely, you know, I was adopting, because I hadn't really talked about it recently to, you know, it had been a thought. He said, well, it doesn't surprise me at all. And I said, why? And he said, you've been talking about this since you were about 25. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there'd been members of my family that were adopted. And I just think it was in me. I just think it was always my path. And in my head, my plan was always, well, I'll adopt my first child. And then if I have a biological child, that will be my second child. Because then, although the first child will be adopted, can always say I was here first, you know. So that was like my young mind planning. It just felt right.
Amazing.
I didn't feel like I needed to be pregnant.
Mm. And you went through the local, is it
local authority?
Local authority.
Yeah. There's different ways of doing it, but that mm-hmm. that felt right for me.
And was there any pushback ever about being a single mum?
Interestingly, I remember going to panel, which is mm-hmm. You go to a panel where you get kind of approved. You know, you've done all the paperwork, you've had a long journey, and it's all about this moment. And I remember saying to the social worker, my social worker, "Do you think that I'm going to struggle to be matched with a child because I'm a solo adopter?" And she said, it will be slightly harder, but it wasn't.
Was it not?
Not really. It really wasn't. You just have to find the right match in a way that, you know, if a child's been in a foster placement with a big family and animals everywhere, for them to come straight to a solo mum, no animals, no other children, no partner, might not be the right fit. But, you know, luckily I did get matched with.
Yeah. How long did the whole process take you from start to finish?
It was a month under 2 years from the day of the meeting to the day my daughter came home.
And that's not too bad, actually.
It's not too bad, no. It can be a bit longer for some people. It can be shorter for some people. It can be sort of as short as 18 months.
Yeah, I've got a friend going through it.
Have you really?
Yeah, so I've heard, you know, some of the details. And I suppose a few things that surprised me was, firstly, how, maybe it's not surprising, how much they really do look into you.
Yes.
So, you know, all the references and the interviews and all of that, which I suppose it isn't surprising. That's quite important.
Yeah.
And, but then also that she's had to go on like courses to learn how to deal with difficult children, because potentially you are taking children that have had a rough beginning.
Absolutely. I think people don't understand. And what I had in the beginning was when I sort of found out how old my daughter was going to be and who she was, and you know, she was sort of around, I don't want to give details away, but she was around one. Mm-hmm. And people said, oh yeah, well, you know, she's only one, she won't remember any of it. As if that was the sort of point of it, as if that was a positive thing. And it's not the remembering, trauma's in the body. And if the minimum that an adopted child goes through is to be separated from their birth mother and then separated from a foster carer, that's still two massive, massive bits of trauma. So that's the least that, you know, a child might go through. But sadly, the majority of children, it's a lot more than that. It really is, especially the older children.
How did you deal with the anticipation of what that trauma might have led to or will lead to in the future?
Yeah, good question again. I read and read and read. I never read. But this was a subject, shame to say, that I'm not obsessed with, but I'm into. I love this subject, the child psychology. How I can help my daughter in the future is why I read about that subject. And I feel quite knowledgeable now on the subject of, you know, adoption and trauma. You do training when you adopt. So you do 4 days training, which is probably what your friend did. But also there's additional training. I had to say yes to all of it. There's a huge thing called the Great Behavioural Breakdown. Mm-hmm. There's people who you now know, and I look on YouTube and watch their videos. There's some real, like, I want to say, like, gods in the world of adoption and in the world of trauma. And you just come to know them so well. And, you know, you have to top up your knowledge, obviously, as the stages come, as your children grow. My goodness. Yeah. Like being a parent in anything, you know, like anyone who's a parent, you know, you have to top up your knowledge. But I find it really interesting, and I know that I can help my daughter go through the things that she has inevitably got to come as she grows, as she gets older.
Yeah, so you're passionate about doing it right.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think, why wouldn't I do it? Why wouldn't I help her in any little way I possibly can?
That's amazing. And it all happened over COVID, is that right?
Yeah.
And did I hear that you met her on Zoom?
Yeah, Zoom. Wow, yeah, I wasn't actually meant to meet her, but the foster carer was, we were sort of having a call with the social workers, and there was sort of a little squeak in the background, and she was amazing, and we still keep in contact with her, actually. And she said, hold on a minute, I know that sound. This sound isn't going to go. So she had kind of no choice but to pick her up, and that was it. I just saw this face.
Wow.
And I said, instinctively, I just sort of said, hiya, Bubba. And she said, hiya, Bubba. And I was like, oh, like heart
really?
Hit with an arrow. Yeah, just, it wasn't like I'm now in love with her, but that was the moment of, whoa, I think this is my daughter. I think this is, which is such a strange sentence even to say, but that was the moment.
Yeah. And then taking her home for the first time.
Yeah. That's the scariest moment of my life. I'm not going to lie.
And you were alone.
Yeah. And I was alone. And it was that weird time where, I mean, I can say it honestly, like, because of the situation I was in, I wanted to break any rule because I felt like I needed it. I needed people. But it was still that strange thing where people were like, it seems mad to look back on, but like, we can't see you. It's like, adopted a child. What do you mean? You can't see me or be there. Yeah. But people couldn't.
No, they could like wave through the window.
Yeah. And they were they had to look after themselves. So luckily there became a few people that kind of saw that I needed them. And
so they were in your bubble.
We bubbled. We absolutely bubbled.
Yeah. And, you know, having a child with a partner is difficult.
Yeah.
But going into that alone, I can imagine, is just must be so scary.
Yeah.
And isolating.
Yeah.
Was it easy? Was it difficult? How did you find the first, you know, few months doing that alone?
I'd say the first year and a half, 2 years maybe. Honestly, I found it really, really hard. There were so many moments of magic, so many moments where I looked at her little face and was like, oh, this is the best thing I've ever done. But amongst that, there was something I now know is called delayed trauma, where she would scream every night for 5 hours solid.
Oh my God.
And I was, you know, beside myself. I didn't know what to do. And that went on for a few months. And that kind of traumatized me slightly, I have to say. Even now when she wakes up at night, I feel immediately full of adrenaline, and I'm trying to sort of curb that at the moment, but it's like an instinctive panic reaction. But it was such a mix. I loved it, but I found it hard. I just needed help. I needed more help than I was allowed to have or could have, or have more help than I got. I really needed people.
Yeah.
But it just wasn't possible.
Well, I remember the nights with a 1-year-old, you know, me and my husband would take it in turns.
Mm.
So I can understand not having the ability to take it in turns, or not having the ability to kind of give your kids to someone and say, I just need that 5 minutes fresh air.
Yeah, absolutely. And after a certain period of time, my dear friend, who always said, if you ever have children, I'm there, she started to have it every Tuesday.
You held her to that.
Yeah, I was like, remember you said this, I've got it recorded. You said. And she's been with us every Tuesday ever since. And even when my daughter goes to school, she'll still be there every Tuesday. And it's going to be hopefully for life, like, you know.
Yeah.
Those safe people in her world, like.
Yeah, and that just gives you that break as well.
Absolutely.
Which is very important. We need to look after ourselves as parents.
Yeah.
You need to look after your own mental, physical health.
Because absolutely.
That's going to make you the best parent possible.
Yeah, totally.
So on top of being a solo mum, how did you then juggle the business as well?
Yeah, that was kind of more planned, I suppose. So I knew when I started the business, I mean, it was just me. And then I sort of bought one person in, two people in, and then it grew over the years. But it was only, I'd say, a couple of years or so before I adopted that the business got to a point where we were sending other people, I was sending other organisers rather, out to work for clients. I had to step back a bit, that hard feeling of it's my business, I want to be a control freak, but I need to see how this works. Because I think even before the adoption, sorry, I say 2 years, but 2 years before I started the process, I had in my head, I think this is the road that I'm going to go down in order to become a mum. I needed the business to run itself. And the biggest thing with that was the organisers that I'd train and find, and it's them being amazing, and they are just amazing. And the second thing, the real sort of glue of the company, is the PA who runs the back end of the business that I'm so not capable of doing, like the diary that I touch it and I mess it up. And
isn't that funny though, that used to be your job?
I know. I don't know how. Now I know why I find it so hard. You know, I found it so hard. But and you know, initially I had someone called Laura. She was 21. She was just a powerhouse. She was the best, amazing, stayed with me 4 years. And now I've got Sarah, who, again, is like this, the real glue of the business. And that's what's changed my life, I have to say. The two of them are what changed my life and how the business ran. You know, I could do it myself and I could make more money because I wouldn't be paying out. But for me, the sanity is worth, and the time with my daughter is worth so much more than extra money in the bank every month. Like, I don't want that bit. It's a pleasure to pay someone to do that because it gives me headspace, it gives me time, and it gives me time with my daughter. Yeah.
Did you struggle at the beginning, though, to give out, like to give away some of those responsibilities, or were you quite good at employing the right people, knowing it was the right people, and then being able to give them those jobs?
I think it definitely took some practice. I think Laura, who I hired first, got my first full-time PA, I think she'd probably say I micromanaged quite a lot. But I think that's natural. It's your baby.
Well, that's why I'm asking. It's hard. It's really hard to delegate when you have such ownership.
Yeah. And even now, even with the organisers, you know, I know if I was watching, I'd be like, oh, I wouldn't do that. I'd do it a bit like this. I'd do it. But actually, their way is also, it's still done in the way that I've trained. Mm. But obviously, we're individuals and individual characters. So how they do it is also absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, if they came to my house and organised my house, which they do, it's also brilliant. So it is taking, you know,
step back
a little bit. Yeah. But it's fine and it's worked well. And it really does give me that balance that I craved in my life.
But also trust. You've got to find Absolutely. That person you fully, fully trust.
Yeah,
that's
definitely.
That's sometimes just not easy.
No, and I've definitely slipped up. I've been in that situation where my business took a huge dive in many ways because I trusted the wrong person.
Yeah.
But I see it also as a bit of fate in there because I wouldn't have ended up working with Sarah now. So
and you probably learnt from that.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely.
So would you say your work-life balance now is optimal?
Do you know what I would? I would say currently I am in the place that I've wanted to always be, especially with my daughter being a bit older, which I find slightly easier than, much easier than when she was tiny. You know, I've got my little buddy and we go travelling and we, you know, get on a plane, it's not a problem anymore. And
she's like a person.
She's a person, and we have a conversation. Yeah. And I really enjoy spending the time with her. I feel like it is at a really good point. I feel like I need to touch wood because I'm jinxing things. Suddenly, she's going to turn into terror.
Enjoy the good moments, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, it's learning to really appreciate it when you're in it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and enjoy the now.
Yeah.
Because, you know, what I always say on this podcast is we're always aspiring for something more.
Totally.
That we don't necessarily enjoy the now and enjoy the moment.
Yeah.
But actually, you know, look at where you've come from, look at what you've achieved and just enjoy that it's all going really nicely.
I learned that too, you know, and I don't know which podcast or who I listened to or read about, probably a million of them. But the fact that we all are looking for the next thing and once we get to that one, there's another one. I have zero of that in me anymore. Mm. I have utter gratefulness for what I have right now.
Yeah.
And I think that is such a huge part of being happy. And I like getting older because you learn these things.
Yeah.
I don't dread getting older now. I'm like, yes, I like this old thing. It works for me.
And then I wanted to talk about another challenge you recently faced. Is that you've recently been diagnosed with ADHD. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
How recent were you diagnosed?
I'd say it must be 8-9 months.
Oh, so very recent.
Yeah,
okay, so
within the last year. Maybe it was a year, I'm not sure. Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, there's quite a lot in the media at the moment about adults being diagnosed with ADHD, and I'm reading lots of varying opinions.
Yeah.
Has your diagnosis as an adult been helpful to you?
Yes, it really has, and I will tell you why. Because I now can forgive myself for the traits that I thought were me being a bit stupid, scatty, forgetful, unable to focus, and a lot of the childhood stuff as well. But I look straight back to childhood with so much of it and it's like, oh my God, I felt like the weirdo when I was a kid. I really did, like the outcast, and I felt a bit different and I felt like I was on the outside of conversations a lot. And the more you delve into ADHD and ADHD in women, all of that is almost on a list. Therefore, you know it's not necessarily you or something you've done, or it's got a reason, I think.
So since your diagnosis, are you changing any of your practices in life?
Yeah.
Really?
I'm definitely changing things. I'm simplifying things even more. because it makes me so much happier.
So do you think that's why you got into professional organising, by the way? Do you think that helped your ADHD brain?
I absolutely think there's a connection there, 100%. Having things in order, removing this massive visual distraction. I believe totally if someone has ADHD, you know, it should be top of their list to declutter their homes and have less kind of, for me, it's almost like if there's stuff everywhere, it's like shouting at you and it's a to-do list sort of hovering around your eyes and it's harder to pick out the bits that are important. So yeah, I feel like it's like a top of the list thing for people to do. But yeah, it's why I think I went down that route.
Yeah. So you've simplified things a lot more.
Yeah.
Anything else you've changed?
I've learnt to not to battle through with the things that I find so hard. So, you know, my PA Sarah is great at diary management, inbox management, emails, form filling, all the things that are daily life. And I've learned that the majority of the time, if I fill in a form, send an email or put something in the diary, I'll do it all slightly wrong. So why am I doing that and then feeling awful about myself when I am lucky enough to be in a position where there is someone with this wonderful brain there who buzzes off the admin and the forms and the emails, who can do it for me while I focus on other things that are more visual and can help my business in a different way.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And have you gone down the medication route at all?
No, I didn't. Do you know, I haven't even thought about it. When I got diagnosed, privately. And when I got diagnosed, there were quite a lot of messages and phone calls and follow-ups about the medication side. But I haven't been interested in it because I initially wanted to digest, live with that diagnosis, and then see if I thought I needed anything else. But actually, I've holistically had coping mechanisms in place, I'd say, for years and years and years now. And it also clarified that, you know, naturally they work and that's naturally what I'd come to. So I just need to build on those, I think.
Yeah. Do you think a lot of adults then build up these coping mechanisms throughout their lives? And actually, maybe those coping mechanisms take up loads of our energy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there can be so many things when you've got ADHD that are so exhausting. And you look at other people and you think, oh, they don't look like they're finding it that hard. Like, what is this? But they are exhausting because your brain is just going at 100 miles an hour trying to figure things out in comparison to people who just find things naturally easy in that way.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. My eldest son has ADHD.
Really?
So I have an insight into it.
Yeah.
And what's been very interesting is as he's got older, he's started to understand it more.
Yeah.
So, you know, at the beginning, he takes medication actually, which has been very, very helpful for him.
Yeah. Like,
especially academically. It's just enabled him at school to concentrate.
Yeah.
And at the beginning, you know, I'd say, do you feel different with your pill? And he was like, he couldn't recognize it when he was very young.
Yeah.
And now he is so much more aware.
Yeah.
You know, so the days, for instance, he doesn't take his pill, he's very aware and he'll say, like, oh, you know, sometimes is he using it as an excuse? He'll say, oh, it's the ADHD.
Definitely. And is he the messy son?
No, he's not.
Oh, that's
he's the tidy one, the one that every so often has to tidy his room and make it very he's very particular about
coping
where things
mechanism.
Are. Oh, he's got great coping mechanisms.
That's amazing. That's me. That's the same. I know I need to have my home organized and have less in it because that will help me. It just comes.
It's coping mechanism. It's so interesting. One of the things that school used to say again before his diagnosis, why does he always put up his hand to go to the toilet?
Yeah.
And that was his coping mechanism for needing a break.
Absolutely.
He just needed to get out of the classroom, have a little movement break and come back.
Yeah.
But, you know, the teachers were like, well, you know, he does it every like 20 minutes. He can't go to the toilet every 20 minutes. But that was his movement break.
He needed to. And now do they listen to that?
Yeah.
And they.
So, again, the diagnosis has really helped him because before that, he was maybe classed as the naughty kid.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's very difficult as well for children with ADHD.
Yeah.
If they're classed as a naughty child.
Yeah.
And now some teachers understand it more than others.
Absolutely, yeah.
But he's not the naughty child anymore. He just maybe has difficulties concentrating or focusing.
Yeah.
But, you know, they know that if he needs a movement break, he goes and has that movement break and then comes back to the classroom and is able to refocus.
Absolutely.
It's very interesting.
It is so interesting. And everyone's ADHD is sort of slightly different and there's slightly different. There's no two the same, right?
What's your opinion on whether more adults should seek diagnosis of ADHD at later stages in their life? Would you recommend it?
For me and my experience, I definitely recommend it. It was actually a friend of mine who got diagnosed that got me looking into it more. I never, ever, ever had ADHD on my radar. But the more I read about it, the more I was like, hold on a minute. And again, it's helped me because I feel like, forgive myself, sounds a bit strong, but it's helped me because I understand now the quirks, which I felt like they were. Mm-hmm. I always just thought I had a bit of a quirky brain, a quirky mind, was a bit different, thought in a different way. It's now got like, it's now I understand completely. And in that way, it's really helped me. And I'll often sort of Google if I'm doing something that I think is a bit odd or that friends maybe wouldn't be thinking in the same way. I'll sort of have a little Google and go, yeah, that is a kind of trait. I mean, one of the most obvious ones from as soon as I had hair was I twiddled my hair. I mean, obsessively twiddled. They put a wig of ribbons on me when I was about 5 and sort of clipped it to my head.
So that you twiddle the ribbons
rather
than your
hair. So I twiddle the ribbons, which obviously never happened. And I still do it to this day. Yeah. And it's quite up there in the list. People either, not either, but some people will pull hair and some people will twiddle.
I play all the time with my hair. My mum goes mad. So on this podcast, I like to ask guests about their resilience.
Yeah.
So you've been through some difficult times, some challenging times with your business, with, adoption.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you are a resilient person or do you feel like you have grown more resilient the more you've been through as an adult?
I think the latter. I think I've grown more resilient the more I've been through as an adult. I feel more evolved in my thinking than I've ever felt. You know, learning that you can't control other people, the way they think or what they do or their actions has been a huge part of that, you know, gaining that understanding. And I think what else has sort of built my resilience is I try not to stop learning about the mind and meditation. And I'm, don't get me wrong, I do not meditate enough at all. But I don't want to stop learning about that. And I think that's a really big help. I want to learn about other people who are resilient and how and why, how they got there. And that hopefully I'll do always and will continue to be hopefully a resilient person.
So do you feel like a resilient person now?
I do because there have been really tricky, you know, quite big situations that have happened in my life. Situation's the wrong word, but you know, my mum has passed away, rejection in things like the adoption world when you know, you're looking at your potential child on a screen and then it's not your potential child. And there's so much around even that 2-year process.
Yeah,
but you have to be resilient. Yeah.
Did your mum pass away when you were young?
My mum passed away about 14 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, 13, 14 years ago. And that was a big one. She was unwell for a very long time. And, you know, I don't think I was so resilient back then, but certainly afterwards, you know, you change. You change as a human.
People talk about how the death of a parent really adds to this innate resilience in us.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. You definitely don't realise it at the time. I don't think you know you're building up this unbelievable level of resilience. But when you look back, it's quite a wow moment to lose a parent or anyone you love.
I think there's a really high proportion of American presidents who lost their parent before age 20.
Really?
Yeah, I can't remember the figure offhand, but it's a very high percentage.
Wow.
So, and also loads of the famous like writers and poets,
yeah,
like Keats, Wordsworth. There's all this research into how if you lose a parent under the age of 20, it just it makes people kind of go on to achieve incredible things.
Yeah.
Quite fascinating.
Yeah, and it actually makes
because out of something so sad and so dark and so terrible can come something amazing down the line.
You get this whole different feel of how precious life is, and more importantly, what is important in life and what just is not. And it can make you look at people differently and friendships differently. I think it can make you question certain relationships and friendships because you're in such a zone of that's not important. It used to be important for me. It used to be big in my world. And now you've got no idea. Just lost my mum. Like, that's not important. Yeah. You can't help but.
Yeah, like I say, you know, I don't sweat the small stuff anymore. No. After my breast cancer.
No.
But I say that, but you know, today when I came in and the tube was messed up, so I was a tiny bit late. And you know, I'm sitting there thinking like, this is really stressful, I'm really stressed. And then I have to kind of remind myself sometimes that actually, hang on, it's only the tube being late.
Yeah.
You know?
What's the worst that could happen?
Yeah.
Worst that can happen. I always think in my head, worst that can happen, I'll be a bit late, I'll apologise. And if that person, i.e. me, say I'd have been, can't believe you're late. It's probably my problem, not yours, right?
Yeah, but it's interesting. It changes our perspectives, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Final question, Vicky.
Yes.
If you could go back in time to when things were their toughest, so let's say during your adoption process, or I don't know if it was during the process or when you'd first adopted her and you're all alone during those, you know, long nights of screaming.
Yeah.
What do you wish you could have told yourself as you were going through that?
I do wish I could go back to that period, actually, as me now. I would have told myself, I would have given me a big hug first, and I would tell myself, I promise in a year, you will look back on this. It's all going to be okay. You'll look back on this and you'll be okay from it. It's not going to last forever.
Yeah.
I mean, mums say it, don't they? When you're going through it, they're like, this is just a period of time. This is a phase.
Yeah.
And inside you're like, that's not helping me tonight. I'm exhausted.
Exactly.
That's not helpful. But they are trying to help. And that's probably what I'd say to someone.
Yeah. And it is the truth.
And it is the truth.
It's always a phase.
The annoying truth.
Where can people find you, Vicky, if they want to know more?
People can find me on Instagram at YouNeedAVicky. And the website, youneedavicky.com, to sort of see what we do, a bit more information about the business.
Great. Thank you so much for talking to us today. I do also honestly highly recommend your book for wanting to make changes. It was a very simple book to read and it has changed my practices at home in the past few weeks. So I'd recommend that. And if anyone is listening, I'm not sure whether to go down the solo parenting or adoptive route. I think you can truly inspire them and give them the confidence to pursue that route. So it's been really interesting speaking to you today. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for listening today to Vicky Silverthorne on When Life Gives You Lemons. I think she's an amazing woman. I would definitely go out and read her book, check her out on Instagram. And I'm going to do a little plea. Please, please, please subscribe to When Life Gives You Lemons. Just go and press the plus in the top right corner. And if you've enjoyed this episode, leave us a review and come back next week for another amazing guest.